Ladies and gentlemen, we are at war. No, I'm not announcing that the United States of America has declared war on another nation, nor am I referring to battling armies with guns and tanks and bombs and the like. Yet this war is very real, and each one of us is a part of it, whether we know it or not. Paul writes in Ephesians 6, verses 10 through 13, "Finally, be strong in the Lord and in his mighty power. Put on the full armor of God so that you may take your stand against the devil's schemes. For our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the powers of this dark world, and against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms. Therefore, put on the full armor of God, so that when the day of evil comes, you may be able to stand your ground, and after you have done everything, to stand." He adds in 2 Corinthians 10, verses 3 and 4, For though we live in the world, we do not wage war as the world does. The weapons we fight with are not the weapons of this world. On the contrary, they have divine power to demolish strongholds. Now, as we continue studying in Hebrews chapter 11, we've come to verses 29 through 31. It's a section that I've entitled Faith Warring. And here the author picks out three examples from the Exodus and the first battle, the conquest of Canaan, to teach us some lessons about faith, particularly in dealing with the spiritual warfare that we are all involved in. Hebrews chapter 11, begin in verse 29, where we see that faith sometimes takes an unlikely path. "By faith, the people passed through the Red Sea as on dry land. But when the Egyptians tried to do so, they were drowned." Now, many of us are familiar with that story, right? If for no other reason, we've seen it on Cecil B. DeMille's classic film, The Ten Commandments. You see that great big wall of water that is being held on one side, and the Israelites walk through on dry ground. Remember that the entire nation of Israel had just been liberated from slavery. They're following Moses into the Sinai wilderness. Pharaoh, who had initially released the Israelites after the 10th plague had taken the life of his own son, changed his mind and ordered his army to bring back the Israelites. Now, the whole nation had the Red Sea in front of them and the Egyptian army behind them, and they didn't have a whole lot of options. I'm reminded of that scene in Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, where they're cornered, and they've got the bounty hunters coming after them, and in front of them is a cliff that leads into a river. And Butch and Sundance are trying to decide what to do. They're looking at their options. And Robert Redford turns to Paul Newman and says, "Well, I guess they could surrender to us, but I wouldn't count on it." Now, I confess, my favorite telling of the story of the Israelites in the Red Sea is in a song by Larry Norman. It's entitled Moses in the Wilderness. I'm just going to read it to you. I wish I could present it the way he does. It's classic. Moses, tending sheep in the fields one day, he thought he heard a burning scrub rush say, "Gotta free your people from the Pharaoh's hand. Gotta take them all to the promised land." Moses knew God was talking to him, so he set off to Egypt with a vigor and vim. And he bugged the Pharaoh, he bugged him and he bugged him, till he got his people free. He used real bugs. Moses, on the banks of the wide Red Sea, stuck out his stick, and 1, 2, 3, the water rolled back, and the people walked down. Everybody knew they wouldn't drown. Pharaoh told his army to bring them all back, and here come the chariots, clickety-clack. Well, Moses took his stick and closed up the water, and the Egyptians all took a bath. Dirty Egyptians. Now, let me be clear about this. The Israelites' faith did not part the Red Sea. Okay? Moses' faith did not part the Red Sea. God parted the Red Sea. But it was the Israelites' faith that walked across the Red Sea on dry ground. Think about it. God could have parted the Red Sea, and there's this long strip of bone-dry ground on what used to be the seabed. And the Israelites could have stood there and thought, well, that's kind of impressive, but what if I get halfway out and he closes it up? It was their faith that got them through. God opened the door, but they had to take some initiative to get across. That's where the faith comes in. See, Moses had told the people in Exodus 14, verses 13 and 14, "Don't be afraid, stand firm, and you will see the deliverance of the Lord that he will bring you this day. The Egyptians you see today, you will never see again. The Lord will fight for you, you only need to be still." What's he saying? Israelites, stop panicking. Stop worrying. Stop stressing. Be still. It's that same Hebrew word that we see in Psalm 46:10. Be still and know that I am God. Cease all of your stressing and striving and fussing and worrying. Trust God in this. He will provide the way. See, this is the power of Almighty God on display here, not the power of Moses or of the group of people. And I'm going to admit, many of those who came out of Egypt with Moses were anything but shining examples of faith. We're going to see a little bit later down the road, if you continue in the Old Testament story, these same people got to the edge of the promised land. They were ready to go in. And they sent some spies to check out the land, and they came back, and 10 of them said, "Ah, we can't do it." And the nation sided with them. And what should have taken about 3 weeks to get from Egypt to Canaan ended up taking 40 years because of their unbelief. But in this one instance, the author of Hebrews sees a glimmer of hope, or maybe I should say a glimmer of faith, where they did trust in God and they did move forward. Yes, it took courage, but it took more than courage. It took faith. Faith that God was going to see them through. Now, it's interesting how the author of Hebrews adds at the end, when the Egyptians tried to go through, they drowned. See, the Egyptians had the same courage as the Israelites. They went into that seabed with all the water on both sides. But they didn't have faith in God. And God closed the waters on them. There was a time when some skeptics liked to claim that the Red Sea was really just a little swampy area with ankle-deep water. And they tried to dismiss the miracle by saying the Israelites just crossed over on ankle-deep water. Well, one quick-minded preacher spoke up and said, well, if that's the case, then even a greater miracle occurred. The Egyptian army was drowned in ankle-deep water. You can't have both. If you're going to accept one, you got to accept the other. But this also points out that what is true for the one of faith is not true for another who has no faith. Think of this. The same waters that bore the ark and saved Noah and his family destroyed all the other life on earth. We're told in the New Testament that the gospel is to one a fragrance of death, but to another a fragrance of life. To those who believe, to those who have faith in Christ, it is salvation. To those who reject Christ, to those who have no faith in him, that same gospel spells their doom. The crucial importance of faith could hardly be more dramatically emphasized than the opposite fates you have between the Israelites and the Egyptians. They both went into the Red Sea on dry ground, but only one came out. And according to Hebrews 11, that's because they had faith. Now, what's the lesson that we can learn from this? We too must go forward. God opens opportunities for us, and sometimes it's an unlikely path. We wouldn't have guessed God to guide us in a particular direction. But when He opens the door, when He provides an opportunity, our response is to be by faith to move forward. It might be easier, it might seem more secure to just stay put. But if God opens a door and says it's time to go, we need to go. That's the faith that those Israelites demonstrated. Secondly, go on to verse 30 in Hebrews chapter 11. This teaches us that faith sometimes takes an unlikely plan. By faith, the walls of Jericho fell after the people had marched around them for 7 days. Now again, this is probably not a new story to us. How many of you grew up going to Sunday school, maybe when you were little? How many of you heard that little chorus, Joshua fit the battle of Jericho? Poor on grammar, great on theology. But we know the story, right? We know how God instructed the army to march around the city once each day for 6 days. And then on the seventh day, they were to march around the city for 7 days, or seven times on that seventh day. Now, archaeologists have discovered that Jericho was quite an impressive fortress of that era. It stood as a guardian to the land of Canaan, where the people of Israel had crossed the Jordan River. And I'm certain that many of the Israelite soldiers probably looked at the walls of that city and wondered, how are we ever going to conquer this? And they might have been envisioning in their minds, you know, oh, we're going to need some ladders or maybe some catapults, although I'm not sure they had invented catapults by then. We're going to have to really do something to conquer this foe in front of us. They're about to learn the truth that faith often requires the conviction that God can do what seems impossible. And He does what is seemingly impossible by seemingly irrational means at times. One commentator writes, "The taking of Jericho is a striking example of the power of faith. Apart from the conviction that God would act, nothing would have been more pointless than the behavior of these warriors. They didn't attack. Instead, they simply walked around the city once a day for 6 days and then seven times on the seventh." See, human wisdom would have said, we need to stockpile slings and catapults and get a bunch of stones for ammunition. Maybe make some ladders we could throw up on the walls and climb over. You know, human wisdom would have suggested maybe digging trenches. Maybe we can get underneath the walls and break in that way. Would have called for maybe setting up a siege around the city and trying to starve the city to death. But faith had a better way. Remember we read earlier in 2 Corinthians 10, we don't wage war as the world does. We don't use the same weapons that the world does. We have weapons that have divine power. The shield of faith, the sword of the Spirit that Paul describes in Ephesians 6 as part of the armor of God. Only complete obedience to the word of God was going to deal with Jericho. Now, can you imagine watching the Israelites walk around Jericho? Imagine that being one of the watchmen at the tower on the wall of Jericho. And you're watching the Israelites just walk around. What are they doing? Do we have any fans of VeggieTales here? Do you even know what I'm talking about? VeggieTales are the cartoon stories of Bible stories, you know, meant for children. They've got one called Josh and the Big Wall. And I'm pretty sure that the guys who made that particular movie must have just watched Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Because as the Israelites are marching around the city, they've got these peas sitting up on the wall taunting the Israelites as they're walking around. It gets the idea, this is ridiculous. This is no battle plan. This is no strategy. And no, it's obedience. God said, this is what I want you to do. And what we find is that faith is it's not believing in spite of evidence. It's not completely irrational, because think about what these same Israelites had been through. They had crossed the Red Sea on dry ground. After that, just not long ago, they had just crossed the Jordan River on dry ground. They had been provided for in the desert. Every day, God gave them manna. They watched water come out of a rock in the middle of the desert. They knew the power of God. This was not irrational. This was trust. And we all know what happened. On that seventh day, they marched around seven times. They blew trumpets. The walls came tumbling down. Now, people have tried to explain it away. Oh, there was an earthquake. Oh, there was this, there was that. Hey, call it what you want. Even if it was an earthquake, it was one that God timed so perfectly that when those trumpets blew, the earth shook. Call it whatever you will. This is the hand of God. F.F. Bruce notes, archaeology can throw much light on the collapse of ancient cities, but the forces that operate in the unseen realm, such as the power of faith, cannot be dug up by an excavator spade. I like that. Science can help, but they can only go so far. It cannot detect the power of God and the power of faith in God. We know how Jericho was defeated by faith and the power of God. So this example teaches us that faith sometimes takes an unlikely plan. And then finally, verse 31 teaches that faith sometimes takes an unlikely person. By faith, the prostitute Rahab, because she welcomed the spies, was not killed with those who were disobedient. I ask you, could there be any more unlikely person in this chapter of faith than Rahab? Think about it. She had three strikes against her. She was a woman. She was a Gentile. And she was a prostitute. I mean, you talk about the depths of sinful people. In the Jew's mind, she had nothing to offer. Nothing redeemable about her. And yet, God used her. And here she is gracing the pages of Hebrews 11, the hall of fame of faith, as some have deemed it. Her name also appears in James 2, again being commended for her faith. And perhaps what's the greatest legacy of all, she is listed in Matthew chapter 1 as the great-great-grandmother of King David. Not only was she spared her life when Jericho was demolished, she was accepted into the family of God. And she became part of the royal family. Through her, not only was King David born, but Jesus was born. If you were to trace Jesus on Ancestry.com, somewhere there'd be a little leaf that says Rahab the harlot. Isn't that amazing? Isn't that incredible that God would use somebody so unlikely to bring about his plan? I love how Howard Hendricks puts it. Rahab, she made it into Hebrews 11. Imagine that. Kind of blows our categories, doesn't it? How much did Rahab really know? If you gave her a theology exam, how do you think she would do? She takes a 38-year-old rumor of the parting of the Red Sea. And when push comes to shove, she goes for broke. She throws everything on the line, and God says, I love it. That's faith. Her faith put the other Israelites to shame. Now, she was obviously an intelligent woman. She had heard the stories of how the Israelites had come out of Egypt, how they had passed through the Red Sea, and then it closed up and destroyed the Egyptian army. And don't think that was some little thing. The Egyptian army was the greatest in the world at that time. She had heard how they had gone through and defeated different kings along the way under Joshua, how they had crossed the Jordan River at flood stage. She had taken in all of this information, and she decided that their God was greater than any of the gods of her people. In fact, what's interesting is when she talks to the spies, she uses the name Yahweh. How would she have known that? It must have been talked about. The word was getting out. And she decided, that's where I'm going to place my faith. I'm going to trust their God, even though she didn't know these people. She had nothing in common with those people. But she said, that's the direction I need to go. These people are going somewhere. My people are doomed. We're sitting ducks here. Unless I do something, I'm going to be right along with them. And so she welcomed the spies. She hid them. She outsmarted her own people when they came looking for them. She showed initiative in arranging the deliverance for her family. How many of you heard of the scarlet cord? That phrase sound familiar at all? The scarlet cord comes from this story. Rahab said, when you're gone, I'm going to put a scarlet cord out my window and you'll know what house is mine. Come get us. Come save my family. She arranged all of that. And she made sure that the spies were able to escape safely. So here is a woman who has nothing going for her in the eyes of the Israelites, and yet showed remarkable faith in God. And because of that, she and her whole family was saved. She's a role model for making the right decisions, for standing firm, even when it means going against your own people, your own peers. It's no wonder that God honored such courage and saved her life. I think Rahab is a living example of what Paul writes in 1 Corinthians 1, verses 26 through 29. Brothers, think of what you were when you were called. Not many of you were wise by human standards. Not many were influential. Not many were of noble birth. But God chose the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. God chose the weak things of the world to shame the strong. He chose the lowly things of this world and the despised things, things that are not, to nullify the things that are. Why? So that no one may boast before Him. See, God often chooses unlikely people to fulfill His plan so that He gets the credit, so that He gets the glory. People look at this and say, that has to be God. It couldn't be this other person. It couldn't be because of that. When people came through this church a couple Sundays ago, and they saw all the work that had been done, and they heard all of the financial resources that went into this work, and they see, by all accounts, a small church that accomplished this, they're shaking their head saying, this had to be God. That's how God works. He works in such a way that nobody can even dream of getting the glory. If they do, they're going to look foolish. God chooses unlikely people. Sometimes He leads us along unlikely paths. Sometimes He comes up with an unlikely plan. And He says, trust me on this. You believe me, I'm going to get you through. And when you're done, you're going to look back and you're going to say, that had to have been God. That's how God likes to work. As we close this evening, I'd like to turn one last passage. It's a very familiar passage. Ephesians 2, verses 8 through 10. Ephesians 2, verses 8 through 10. You could probably quote it from memory, at least part of it. Paul writes, "For it is by grace you've been saved through faith, and that not of yourselves, it is the gift of God, not of works, so that no one can boast. For we are God's workmanship, created in Christ Jesus to do good works, which God prepared in advance for us to do." Warren Wiersbe explains how Rahab fulfills these verses. And I think he does a great job. I'd like to share it with you tonight. Rahab was saved by grace because the other inhabitants of the city of Jericho were marked out for death. God, in his mercy and grace, permitted Rahab and her family to live. But she was also saved by faith. What she knew about God is recorded in Joshua 2, verses 8 through 14. She knew that Yahweh had delivered Israel from Egypt and they had opened the Red Sea. But that had been 40 years before. She also knew that God had defeated the other nations during the wilderness wanderings. And she said, "For the Lord your God," there's Yahweh, "He is God in heaven above and in the earth beneath." That was her testimony of faith, and God honored it. But lastly, Rahab was saved unto good works. True faith must always show itself in good works. She protected the spies, she put a cord in the window as directed, and apparently won her family to the true faith. In every way, she obeyed the Lord. Not only was Rahab delivered from judgment, she became a part of the nation of Israel. She married Salmon and gave birth to Boaz, who was an ancestor of King David. Imagine a pagan harlot becoming part of the ancestry of Jesus Christ. That is what faith can do. Rahab is certainly a rebuke to unsaved people who give excuses for not trusting Christ. "I don't know very much about the Bible," is an excuse I often hear. Rahab knew very little spiritual truth, but she acted on what she did know. "Oh, I'm too bad to be saved," is another excuse. Rahab was a condemned heathen harlot. Another excuse is, "Well, what will my family think?" Rahab's first concern was saving her family, not opposing them. She stands as one of the great women of faith in the Bible. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, we are at war. It's an invisible war, but the battles are real nonetheless. In this warfare, there is only one route to victory: faith in our God. Faith sometimes takes an unlikely path, sometimes an unlikely plan, sometimes an unlikely person. So in the final analysis, it is God who gets the glory. I'd like to end this evening, if you'll take your hymnals one last time, turn to hymn number 425. Hymn number 425, "Faith is the victory that overcomes the world."